Hello and welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell. One of the biggest issues to emerge from the interim report of the Royal Commission into Aged Care Quality and Safety was the use of psychotropic medications. A group of researchers from the Registry of Senior Australians, Monash University, Flinders University and other institutions has found that 60.8% of elderly Australians in aged care received at least one psychotropic medication in their first 3 months of residential care. 21.3% of them were prescribed at least one antipsychotic. 30.5% of them received at least one benzodiazepine, and 37.9% received at least one antidepressant in their first 3 months of residential care. Our special guest today is Associate Professor Craig Whitehead, who is a geriatrician and a regional director of Southern Adelaide Local Health Network. Craig is a co-author of the research, and he's here to talk about the implications and dilemmas of prescribing antipsychotics in this population, particularly in those with dementia. When we're talking about psychotropics, what medications specifically are we talking about?
So we included in this study three main classes of drugs: benzodiazepines, which are sleeping tablets, so that's your Serapax or temazepam will be common brand names. We included antidepressants, which there's countless different variations, but you know, a common drug might be a common brand name might be Zoloft or those sort of drugs, I think, or citalopram or cipramil. Those are quite common antidepressants that are used in the market now, though there are literally 30 or 40 different ones. And then antipsychotics, which is the drugs that have had most notoriety, that is, of which the commonest is the drug risperidone, which has been talked about a lot in the context of the Aged Care Royal Commission and is the drug for which the best evidence of harm exists. But that's not to say that there isn't evidence of harm for the other two classes of drugs. It's just less well known.
So why do we prescribe them? Obviously, sleeping disturbances, depression.
Well, it's an excellent question. So these three classes of drugs are relatively widely prescribed in the community. And I guess the first thing that was quite striking, we've published a couple of things in this space now, but what is really quite striking when you look at this, the majority of residents in aged care are on a mind-altering drug. You know, the minority have nothing. So there aren't many populations in our community where you've got 70% who are taking this. And it's not as if the population is exclusively filled with people with primary mental illness. In fact, the prevalence of major depression is not estimated to be 30 to 40% of this population. It's estimated to be, you know, 3 or 4%. So I think there is a lot of prescribing. And we know, and the complexity of that, of course, is that when you look at the population we're dealing with, who are all physically very frail, generally speaking, have higher prevalence of cognitive impairment and dementia. You look at that population, the evidence base to support the use of any of these three classes of drugs is patchy at best. And I think this is one of the great challenges for healthcare, not in this country, but for generally in what is essentially a fairly forgotten, and if you follow the Royal Commission's title, neglected group of people. You know, we've got challenges in that the science we have available doesn't answer the questions that we clinicians need answering. So what is the best way of managing insomnia? There's really little research done in this group. The evidence would suggest that the effects of drugs like benzodiazepines for treating sleeplessness wear off. You know, they all have problems with physical addiction and dependency. So once you start them, they're very hard to stop. And there is also evidence in the national guidelines, which we were involved in helping developing. You know, one of the strongest evidence-based recommendations in the treatment for dementia is that antidepressants starts with depression after dementia starts actually don't work. And yet we've got, you know, 25-30% of these people on these drugs. Conversely, we do have some targeted evidence that would suggest, for example, agitation in dementia is shown to be improved by the use of an antidepressant. There is evidence that the antipsychotics do reduce behaviours or change behaviour in dementia, but they come at a cost in mortality and stroke risk. It needs to be a nuanced discussion about how long you have been on this drug, how long you remain on it, and so forth. So I think we've got, there's a massive practice evidence gap. There isn't the evidence available. Practice would suggest we're using these drugs a lot, but we can't go back like in, say, treating heart failure, where you've got 20, 30 well-designed, large-scale papers that tell you what medications you should use and what the pros and cons are. And I think that's a great challenge for modern medicine, is how do you design good research to tell us the best way to use these drugs in this population on a background of what seems to be an enormously high prescribing rate and potentially inappropriate prescribing rate.
Which leads us directly to this paper where you looked at prescribing rates before seniors enter aged care and after. Tell us a little bit about the design study and how you went about getting your data.
One of the questions we were really keen to answer was, you know, the aged care industry at the moment, arguably fairly, but certainly publicly, has been heavily criticised for these drugs. You know, it's been widely publicised that there's high prevalence of this drug, and the implication being that they're responsible for all the prescribing. But we were very keen looking at, because we had the ability to do this, to track use over time, see actually what the patterns were over time. And what we found quite interesting is that there's a sort of a doubling in the 3 months before you go in and then a doubling after you go in. So, yes, going into care has an impact on your prescribing, but potentially the reasons, the indications, maybe changed behaviour, maybe getting more agitated, which is what leads to your admission into aged care, is also driving the prescribing. So I think, you know, one of the issues is, and I'm sure the levels are higher than they need to be, but yes, one of the issues that, and a number of my GP colleagues have said this back to me when we've been discussing this in other forums, is we get hammered about them being on the drug. We never get hammered about whether they should be on the drug. And, you know, it's about appropriateness of prescribing, because there will be an appropriate level of risperidone use in people with dementia. I mean, I prescribe it. I see a lot of patients with quite severe behavioural disturbance, so I'm likely to prescribe it commonly, but you should be going through a fairly rigorous checklist, thinking about withdrawing it, making sure that families are consented for the risks. Mm. And that's something I feel very strongly about. That clearly, if you look at this data, many families are often not aware that these medications are being used in their loved ones, which is, you know, frankly, that really is unacceptable.
Or if they're aware, they don't know enough about the drug to know.
I don't know enough about them. Yeah. I mean, it's very common for me to talk to quite well-educated, informed children who are the legal guardians of their relatives with cognitive impairment. And I said, did you realise your mum was taking an antipsychotic? And they said, no, no one ever told me that was started. I mean, I cannot tell you how many times I've had that conversation. It's an interesting dilemma. And I think no doctor's pure as snow. I mean, we don't always succeed, but I always aspire to make sure that the conversation is had. I teach my registrars and my junior doctors to do that. And in my experience, if you've got a severely, someone with significantly advanced dementia who's quite agitated and upset, or possibly quite paranoid or fearful, and you say this drug might work, but we are carrying a risk of this, people will say, look, you know, she's got dementia, she's not going to live forever anyway. And I think there is this sort of almost palliative use of these medications in the same way that we might palliate other symptoms in a terminal illness with morphine or an opioid. Yeah. You're in this slightly unusual grey zone of medical practice, because people wouldn't consider dementia would be an illness that you need to palliate, but people do die from it.
Absolutely.
And we know that behavioural disturbance often is heralds that last phase of their life, which may last months. We need to have a much more, I think, open conversation with our patients and families and the medical profession about the palliation of this condition. And that may well include the use of antipsychotics. But, you know, that's, in my mind, that's a healthy discussion to have. That's a balanced, reasoned discussion to have. No one would disagree with that. And the problem is currently what happens is that people get on these drugs and there is none of that discussion going on. And I think, you know, you wouldn't undergo a surgical procedure carried risk of death or injury without a consent process. I think that's one of the challenges that the data shows us. I mean, first of all, I think what the study we've done shows us is it's not simply aged care's fault. It's not being used as a sort of chemical cost to reduce, you know, nursing costs, which is often the way it's portrayed. I think there is an interaction between the illness of dementia, the care setting. We have limited available treatments to reduce what can be a very distressing condition for both the people caring for them and the family members and the individual, who can often be very anxious and upset. So it's about finding the right level of use and having appropriate controls. And at the moment in the aged care industry, and I'm open disclosure, I am on the board of an aged care provider, so I've got some role in governance there. You know, the message coming out from the regulators and governments that all use of these drugs is chemical restraint. Well, it's not all chemical restraint. Sometimes they're treating symptoms.
I mean, that's certainly the impression that's come out in the media surrounding the commission, is that we're almost talking about elder abuse when we give them these drugs. And I'm sure there are instances of that.
Well, and I think the challenge is that for patient A, it might be elder abuse, but patient B, it might actually be a well thought through treatment.
Yes.
And, you know, so you can't throw the baby out with the bath. I think the other thing that the study showed to me, which was not something that we weren't surprised by, is that the incidence never goes down. So we know when that first 3 months to 6 months when someone moves into care, I mean, you could imagine if you've ever moved house, you're pretty stressed. and you've got normal cognition, and if you've got impaired cognition and you're moving into a facility, you know, it's no wonder that first 3 months of sort of readjustment period is quite disruptive. The drugs never get stopped. And I suppose what we will often see, I see patients who come in medically from residential aged care in our hospital here. I work in Salem, and you know, they'll be on an antipsychotic. They've clearly been on it for some time. I've never met them before, but I'm looking and thinking, they don't need this. This could have been stopped because they've got side effects from it. Their swallowing might be affected. And you look back through the notes, they've not had behavioural disturbance for a long period of time. So the issue about sensible drug withdrawal after a reasonable course of treatment for a well-defined problem is really important. It's just that these are quite complex prescribing procedures to go through. It's not like just taking a course of antibiotics. They need regular review. You need to engage families. You need a certain level of skill with the problem. And, I mean, how available that all is to the aged care, residential aged care population, I guess that's an issue that needs to be addressed. There is a crisis in primary care and residential aged care. Yep. I mean, a number of very senior GPs got very angry when I said that. But, you know, I received an email the other day for a nursing home on the outskirts of Adelaide where 15 of the residents have no regular GP.
Wow.
They're looked after by the locum service. Those stories are probably found in every part of Australia. And I do a number of coronial reviews for, you know, for deaths in nursing homes for the coroner's office in South Australia. And it's very common to see the medical care being delivered after five. Like when you're reading the notes, not always.
Yep.
By all means, there are GPs who come in office hours and do it. But, you know, there's a number of cases I've seen where they don't see a GP for a long period of time. The GP's in, you can see when they've timed it, but they're after five. Or the locum service is rewriting the drug chart. There's a lot of strain under primary care in residential aged care, and it's an issue that needs to be addressed. And similarly, there is, I mean, fortunately, there is an increase in supply of geriatricians in Australia.
Yep.
We are. It's the second or most popular training program in the College of Physicians. So there will be more geriatricians, and I think there will be possibility of practice in residential aged care. Again, there's probably an economic issue around how easy that will be for people to do, because really someone needs to visit the site for these people, because it's very hard for them to access conventional specialty specialist rooms. That's often the case for people, is that who go into care, that they will cease any connection with their private specialist who they might have seen previously, because, you know, you need an ambulance to take you to the doctor's room as well. I mean, that's just not feasible.
I'm chatting today with Craig Whitehead, who is a geriatrician. Craig's co-authored research is available on mja.com.au, where it is open access. There's also a news story on the topic at Insight Plus. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can catch up on our other episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts. And for future episodes, you can subscribe on iTunes to our free feed. Back to our chat. So let's just do a quick summary of what you found, or what impression I'm getting of what you found, and correct me if I'm wrong. We're prescribing at a fairly high rate before they hit the aged care facilities.
Yep.
Is there an idea of how much of that is appropriate and how much isn't?
I think we've shown a signal. We've got no idea how much is appropriate. Clearly, some of it will be. Some of it will be inappropriate.
Yep.
I mean, part of the dilemma we have is we say for severe behaviour, but, you know, defining, getting a definition of severe behaviour between 15 different people, because it's hard. And I think, you know, severe behaviour in one level, if you've got an environment where the staff won't tolerate any form of behaviour, well, then something really simple becomes severe. And, you know, one of the things that's really not been well addressed in this area as a researcher, other thing, is about how do we make workforces more resilient to deal with what are very challenging problems.
Yes.
And so, you know, if I have a patient who's very agitated in a surgical ward, those nurses don't tolerate it as well as the nurses who've admittedly self-selected to work in our dementia ward, you know, where they take pride in the skill of managing behaviour and are really quite conscientious about reducing the use of medication.
Yeah.
And so I think there is an issue around training, about resilience of staff. You know, there's a lot of push through, and again, this will be terribly unpopular, but there's a big push through to the ANMF and other things say we must have hospitals and aged care have zero violence. Well, if you're caring for people with dementia, how can you legislate zero violence unless you anaesthetise them? And we conversely say that's not right for the individual. And we need to have an honest conversation that if we're going to have a large population with dementia, we're going to have significant but small numbers, relatively speaking, to the whole population who are going to be quite disturbed. And we need to put, we need to think about how do we best care for that small group of people. And to be honest, it's not necessarily going to be cheap, but it needs to be done properly. And staff need to be supported and rewarded for developing the skill in caring for that very unfortunately disturbed group of people. Because unlike a lot of other mental illness, it's not really terribly modifiable by drug treatment. And I'm not sure that necessarily, I hopefully the Royal Commission will get some of the subtlety, I hope, as opposed to it just being attacking the aged care industry, because I don't know that that's necessarily helpful either.
No. And the other big issue I'm seeing from your results is that, yes, the prescribing rate jumps in the first 3 months after entry into facilities, but there are a lot of reasons for that. And the big issue perhaps is de-prescribing after a certain amount of time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the key. I think that's the other key message is that there will be appropriate use, but how do we de-prescribe these drugs in a way that's safe? There's some rigour around it. And again, we don't have a lot of literature to guide us on that. And I think there is, you know, there's a huge opportunity for further scientific endeavour looking at, you know, specifically how you deprescribe. There are a number of people doing deprescribing studies, but they've not specifically focused on psychotropics and in the dementia case, in the dementia situation. And of course, the problem is, you know, these are it's a hard thing to sell often where if the patient's settled, why upset the apple cart? And it goes back to my point about staff resilience, staff training. Yeah. And if you've got someone who's severely agitated, the nursing care they need is a lot more than the 2.5 hours per nursing day that you get in a regular aged care facility. And I think we need to be honest about that. There's a small number of people who need a lot more money spent on them to care for them in a way that's safe for the staff and safe for the patient.
You mentioned earlier that severe behaviour disturbances and violence or whatever is often an indication that they're coming to the end of their life.
Can be.
Yep. How does dementia actually kill you?
Gee, that's a great question. I'm not sure that we entirely know the answer to it, but there are three processes that are fairly clear, rarely discussed with people, and people don't often raise it with me when I'm counselling them. Sometimes they do, but there are three main pathways we know of. Pathway one is that you fall. So falling as you go through the illness becomes more common. You break your hip, which is... You can break other fractures, but that's the prototypical fracture. And so we know patients with dementia are twice as likely to break their hip than not. That usually causes a period of cognitive decline. I mean, there's about a 7% in-hospital mortality for hip fracture. And then what that will do is probably turn someone from being ambulant to being bedbound, and you'll then start to develop the complications of bed rest, which include respiratory compromise. Yeah. And you're more likely to develop pneumonia. And so you can go down, that's one pathway. And these are not all mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. The other thing that tends to happen as dementia comes towards its last phase is that your ability to swallow deteriorates. And so you won't be able to, ultimately won't be able to safely, you may not be able to safely swallow your saliva, and that's full of bacteria, and that's what pneumonia is. So the old man's friend, reasons why you would develop it. The third pathway, which I cannot explain, but I've witnessed it several times, is that your brain reaches a point where it can no longer sustain the body. I remember vividly, probably last year, and it dawned on me then, I don't know, I've been a geriatrician for 25 years, it should have dawned on me before then, but it really struck home to me last year where I've been sort of mulling this idea over my head, and it really brought it home as a gentleman who was in our dementia ward, and he just got really agitated, and then he just got progressively more drowsy. He couldn't swallow. He wasn't eating anymore. He was clearly dying, and he died. But he died relatively quickly, and I could only ascribe it to just the failure of his brain. There is often in this very last phase of dementia, I mean, that, you know, if you don't eat, you can't indefinitely live.
Sure.
And there does become a period of time where people they don't eat anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another common final pathway, is that the desire to eat, you're so agitated or you're so pacing that you can't eat. Nutrition, you get more delirious, and maybe that affects your swallowing, so you're getting more respiratory compromise because you can't swallow. I mean, they're all kind of linked together.
Yeah.
But some people just seem to get agitated, stop eating, become drowsy and die. And I just Is it the brain just failing completely? It's a difficult question because, of course, no one comes back from you to tell you what's going on. And you know, occasionally when these people have autopsies, the pathologists will write multi-organ failure. I mean, they can't find anything either. Yeah. There is no doubt that the process of not eating, delirium, poor swallow is a common final pathway.
Yeah.
But some people just said, you know, you can ascribe it to that, but it seems even more fundamental than that, that their brain just stops working. We don't often talk about the practical realities of death enough. Mm. You can successfully relieve the symptoms in the last phases of a sort of frailty dementia death. It's not, you know, the palliative care is not complicated. I think, you know, without going off on a tangent, it's much more challenging in our current debate about euthanasia and voluntary assisted dying because, you know, so many of us when we die will be unable to ask for euthanasia. None of these patients can have volition anymore. And, you know, that seems to be a neatly ignored fact that, and I mean, you know, in Belgium where they've had much more progressive euthanasia rules, there is involuntary assisted dying. You know, if you lack capacity, someone else can decide to end your life. And I'm not sure that's where I would think our society should go. But I mean, you know, I'm open to the debate. I've got no personal objection to people voluntarily choosing to die. The dilemma with this end of life and dementia is that, you know, if you wanted to have the capacity to make that decision, you have to do it when your quality of life's not terrible. It's an unanswerable dilemma. And it's going to be a much bigger problem. And I guess at some stage, society's going to have to decide about how far we go down the involuntary assisted dying route. And I mean, I think that's a much more challenging
conversation. Oh, it is.
The dilemma for us is that this problem of neurodegeneration, dementia, frailty is going to be a very common pathway for death in the next 40 to 50 years. I think people are very frightened about thinking because it's so, that sort of loss of identity and self is so challenging. I think people would prefer not to talk about it. I mean, you know, I have to talk about it because it's my job. Our traditional view of death, which is the kind of cancer death, is one of those things that is relevant and needs to be well looked after. Don't get me wrong. A lot of these sorts of deaths pose their own challenges, and how we as doctors and as a community manage this problem, it's going to be quite challenging for us because it is going to get to the issue about do we do as we would do with our animal. We would euthanize an animal well before they got to this point. Having had this discussion with a number of vets, I think doctors are crazy.
Yeah.
Not argue. But
anyway,
it's an interesting debate.
It is an interesting one. I mean, bringing it back to psychotropics, do psychotropics make it harder to... Do psychotropics mask the natural process of the disease?
Unfortunately, they probably accelerate the disease, one of the prices you pay.
Yeah.
So all of the psychotropic drugs, maybe less so the antidepressants, but certainly benzodiazepines and the antipsychotics have been shown to accelerate dementia. And certainly the antipsychotics affect swallowing and thirst and the ability to, you know, take nutrition in. So in that context, they may well accelerate some underlying problems. So, you know, that's part of the reason why people die.
Yeah.
There is an increased risk of death with antipsychotic use almost certainly. What we don't know is how much excess morbidity there is from the use of benzodiazepines, because despite them being so prevalent in dementia patients, there's almost no research. There are no randomized controlled trials to show that benzodiazepines help with anxiety or agitation in dementia. But they're incredibly widely prescribed, and we use them all the time, but because it's accepted practice, but it's not guided by high-level evidence. We need to try and understand the harms better. And there is certainly some evidence that prolonged use of benzodiazepines can worsen cognitive decline. It would be a tricky area to research now because, I mean, everybody can see 25% of the population are using them. It's very hard to randomise people to placebo in that kind of clinical context.
Exactly.
There are a lot of both scientific, ethical and societal challenges. And, I mean, really all our data is a signpost for that.
Yep.
Challenge. I guess we've got to start trying to unpack it piece by piece, but I think certainly I think the deprescribing of antipsychotics is going to be quite important.
Wave your magic wand for me, Craig. What would you do now if you could?
If I could, I think I would love to see a change in the debate from punishing aged care and pointing them out, but making them a partner with the rest of the health and aged care system, making us partners so that we can actually improve the quality and have the resources and the infrastructure to allow that. Because if you look at hospital care, it's developed over my working life a massive increase, move from a massive improvement in quality assurance and quality improvement, which is a sort of huge industry in healthcare. It's really in Australian aged care is at a very nascent level, but giving people aged care the ability to understand their business, understand their quality, share that with other aged care providers, share with other people who can help them improve their quality and improve. This has been happening in hospital care for a long time and has led to improvements in safety in hospital care. And I know it's not much of a magic wand wish, but I'd much rather they went down that route, which is sadly where I think it will go, is excessive compliance and regulation and sort of old-fashioned monitoring and telling them off, because actually all that'll do is leading them to hide the problem.
Thanks, Craig. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.